sailors were ragged and worn in. It wasn't long till we were counting the days till graduation. We were dreaming of Oregon. You had a cousin in Portland. He had his very own place. So we hatched a scheme for how we get away. Found courage in the bourbon, like sponges we soaked in the night, until we sank down and huddled up against the bonfire. We were drunk on our youth and the band and the sound, and I held your head that night. You cried your eyes out on the curb after he crushed your heart with a single word. Julia, you did your best. It's freezing in Columbus. Did you ever make it west? Well, I was quiet, you were reckless, and the boys liked you better, and in truth I did mine. I was thunder to your lightning. You were flame, I was embers, and it scared me sometimes. And just being close to you, it felt like diving from the sky. You couldn't stem the bleeding, and neither could I. Julia, you did your best. It's freezing in Columbus. Did you ever make it west?
WRCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
One of the things that we pointed out in all of these so-called battleground states, and even in the South, that many of these states are not red or blue as much as they are untapped and unorganized. Trump won in by 74,000 votes in the last election, but there were over 1 million poor and low-wage voters that did not vote.
As Donald Trump wins the presidency and Republicans take the Senate and probably the House, where did the Democrats go wrong? We'll speak with Bishop William Barber, head of the Poor People's Campaign, co-author of White Poverty: How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. We'll also talk with former Bernie Sanders advisor David Sirota, editor-in-chief of The Lever, about election 2024, how billionaire Avengers destroyed democracy. Then to Gaza.
Even here, we have to wait 2.5 hours. By now, it could be much longer to go to the next checkpoint where there are Israeli forces, to go to their second checkpoint to get to the north. Symbol of how difficult it is to do any principled aid work for the long-suffering civilian population here in Gaza.
We'll speak with Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, who's just left Gaza, as UNICEF describes the conditions in northern Gaza as apocalyptic. They say that northern Gaza is on the verge of death. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Donald Trump has named Florida Republican operative Susie Wiles as White House Chief of Staff for his incoming administration. She will become the first female Chief of Staff in U.S. history. Wiles led Trump's 2024 presidential campaign and previously his Florida operations in 2016. She also worked on the gubernatorial campaign of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Overnight, several news outlets projected Trump would win the state of Nevada, expanding his victory to 301 Electoral College votes. Trump's leading in Arizona, making it likely he'll complete a sweep of battleground states. Control over the House of Representatives remains unresolved, with more than two dozen House races yet to be called. Republicans have won 211 of the 218 seats needed to retake their House majority. Democrats have won 199 seats. In one closely watched race, Long Island Democrat Laura Gillen has defeated incumbent Republican Congressmember, former police detective Anthony Desposito, who represents New York's 4th District. Republicans are poised to expand their Senate majority in Pennsylvania. Several news outlets have projected Republican Dave McCormick will defeat incumbent Democratic Senator Bob Casey. However, Casey's refused to concede, and the very close race could be headed to a recount. In Arizona's Senate race, with three-quarters of ballots counted, Democrat Ruben Gallego holds a 1.7 percentage point lead over Republican challenger Carrie Lake, the far-right election denier and Trump ally. Trump's allies are celebrating Tuesday's victory with calls to implement the far-right policy plan to overhaul the federal government, known as Project 2025. Former White House advisor Steve Bannon Wednesday amplified a message by the far-right podcast host Matt Walsh, who tweeted, quote, "Now that the election is over, I think we can finally say that, yeah, actually Project 2025 is the agenda, LOL. A federal judge on Thursday struck down a Biden administration policy that would grant undocumented spouses of U.S. citizens a pathway to U.S. citizenship without having to leave the United States. Trump-appointed judge J. Campbell Barker sided with Texas and over a dozen other Republican-led states, declaring the program illegal. The Keeping Families Together program was expected to benefit some 500,000 mixed-status families. Even if Biden's Justice Department appeals the ruling, the case is likely to stretch into the incoming anti-immigrant Trump administration. On Thursday, Trump told NBC there's no price tag on his plans to launch mass deportations as soon as he comes into office. The American Immigration Council estimates such a plan would cost nearly $1 trillion over 10 years. Here in New York, hundreds of immigrant justice advocates and their allies gathered in Lower Manhattan Thursday evening and vowed to protect immigrant New Yorkers and fight against the incoming administration. This is community organizer Jorge Paz Reyes.
Donald Trump has and will continue to vilify our stories, to portray us as unworthy, and his deportation agenda seeks to divide and just create chaos within our communities. That is why we need to stand united and declare that immigrants are not the problem. We are the solution.
Yeah! Israel continues to bomb the Gaza Strip, with reports of nearly two dozen Palestinians killed since dawn. This follows an Israeli attack Thursday in a school-turned-shelter in Gaza City's Shati refugee camp that killed at least 12 Palestinians and wounded 30 others. Survivors said the bombing came without warning.
We were baking bread and our children were sitting around us and we were at the bottom and we saw nobody and the floor shook. The bomb hit and all the tents were destroyed. People ran. Some people were martyred on the floor. Rubble fell on us and people were torn to pieces. Where is the humanity? Where is the rest of the world? Where is the mercy? We have never seen any nation waging war on children. I am 65 years old and I've never seen any nation waging war on children.
For the last 7 weeks, Israel has allowed almost no food or aid into northern Gaza, as the UN's repeatedly warned the entire northern population is, quote, at imminent risk of dying, unquote. Meanwhile, the United Nations Human Rights Office reports nearly 70% of the more than 43,000 Palestinians killed by Israel over the last 13 months are women and children. That number is expected to be an undercount. On Thursday, Israel's military said it had secured 25 next-generation F-15 fighter jets from Boeing. The $5.2 billion deal is part of a larger U.S. funding package to Israel approved by Congress and provided by the Biden-Harris administration. Many Gaza residents fear Donald Trump's election won't bring an end to the flow of weapons that have laid waste to much of Gaza.
Biden sent a lot of weapons, rockets, bombs, you know. Those, you know, weapons helped the Israeli occupation do their disgraceful acts to the Palestinian people and the Gazans especially.
Spain has denied harbor to two ships operated by the Danish company Maersk, which were believed to be carrying weapons to Israel. El País reports the ship set sail from New York. On Thursday, Turkey's ambassador to the United Nations, Ahmet Yildiz, renewed demands for a global arms embargo on Israel as he addressed UN reporters. Turkey and another 50 nations recently sent a joint letter to the United Nations pressing for an end to Israeli arms transfers.
We cannot stress enough that the staggering civilian toll, predominantly affecting women and children, resulting from ongoing breaches of international humanitarian and human rights law is both unacceptable and intolerable.
Two Canadian Palestinian citizens are suing the government of Canada for violating its duty to prevent genocide. This is attorney Shane Martinez.
Our claim alleges that Canada, by failing to fulfill its legal duty to take all reasonable measures to prevent the crime of genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza, did causally contribute to violations of our clients' rights under the Charter.
The plaintiffs in the case have lost family members to Israel's assault on Gaza, which they argue Canada has illegally abetted. Activists in New York have joined a global hunger strike movement to end the war on Gaza. They're holding vigils outside the UN headquarters today and over the weekend to call attention to Israel's catastrophic 13-month-long assault. Dozens of activists in Amman, Jordan, launched their hunger strike a week ago. This is Mohammed Al-Tabasi.
We had the idea in response to international calls to pressure through a global hunger strike in order to break the siege on northern Gaza. From there, no one has anything more precious than his health. So we decided to use our health as a form of pressure. Hunger strike, as we all know, is a form of pressure and peaceful resistance to achieve a certain demand.
Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, who's just come out of Gaza. He'll speak to us from Amman, Jordan. Israel's military is continuing deadly attacks on southern Lebanon, including an airstrike on Sidon that killed three civilians while wounding five United Nations peacekeepers. A separate strike Thursday in the eastern Baqa Valley destroyed the historic Al-Manshiya building, an Ottoman-era structure just yards away from the Roman temples of Baalbek, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Israeli attacks on Lebanon have killed over 3,100 people. In climate news, a new UN report finds financing from wealthy nations to help poor countries adapt to the climate crisis totaled $28 billion in 2022, far short of the $359 billion that's needed. The report was released ahead of next week's UN climate summit in Azerbaijan, where financing is set to be a key issue. This is UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Climate catastrophe is hampering health, widening inequalities, harming sustainable development, and rocking the foundations of peace. The vulnerable are hardest hit, and taxpayers are footing the bill. While the purveyors of all this destruction, particularly the fossil fuel industry, reap massive profits and subsidies. Meanwhile, the gap between the funds needed for adaptation and the funds available to developing countries is set to reach up to $359 billion a year by 2030.
Democracy Now! Will be in Baku, Azerbaijan, to cover the UN climate summit. Tune in. In Bolivia, wildfires have ravaged 75,000 acres of the Medidi National Park. Half of that is pampas or wetland savannas. The park is home to over 1,200 bird species, 270 types of mammals, hundreds of species of fish, amphibians, and reptiles. This is a park ranger.
Cuidamos una joya natural, ¿no?
We protect a natural gem, both in biodiversity and landscape and culture. That is why Medidi Park is considered as one of the world's 10 most biodiverse parks in the world. The place that is burning is very important because it is the second place with the largest population of jaguars in South America.
A wildfire is also raging in Southern California. In Mozambique, police fired tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters Thursday, killing an estimated 5 people and injuring 120 others amidst ongoing post-election turmoil. The long-ruling Frelimo party declared victory last month, triggering protests and accusations of a rigged election by the opposition leader, Venancio Mondlane, and his supporters. At least 24 people have been killed in unrest, according to a local rights group. This is a resident of Maputo.
I think the situation is terrible. For better or for worse, what is happening is harming the population. We are the ones who are suffering. I think the parties should sit down and talk for the good of the population, because it is the population that is suffering.
And Australia may soon become the first country to ban social media use for children under 16 years old. The ban could take effect in roughly a year's time if the government's proposal is approved by the Australian Parliament. This is Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
Social media is doing social harm to our young Australians, and I am calling time on it. The safety and mental health of our young people has to be a priority, and my government will do all that we can to protect our young Australians, but also to provide support for parents and teachers who are dealing with these issues.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Donald Trump and his allies celebrated his election victory with calls to implement the far-right policy plan to overhaul the federal government known as Project 2025, as Republicans also took the Senate and will probably take the House. Meanwhile, at the White House, President Biden Thursday said he'd called President-elect Trump to congratulate him and promised a peaceful transition of power.
The struggle for the soul of America, since our very founding, has always been an ongoing debate and still vital today. I know for some people, it's a time for victory, to state the obvious. For others, it's a time of loss. Campaigns are contests of competing visions. The country chooses one or the other. We accept the choice the country made. I've said many times, you can't love your country only when you win. You can't love your neighbor only when you agree. Something I hope we can do, no matter who you voted for, is see each other not as adversaries, but as fellow Americans. Bring down the temperature. I also hope we can lay to rest the question about the integrity of the American electoral system. It is honest, it is fair, and it is transparent. And it can be trusted. win or lose.
President Biden spoke in the Rose Garden a day after Vice President Kamala Harris conceded her loss in a speech at her alma mater, Howard University.
While I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign.
We begin our look at where Democrats went wrong with Bishop William Barber, national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, which sought to increase voting among low-income residents, an often ignored but massive bloc. He's a senior lecturer, repairs of the breach, and founding director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School, co-author of the new book, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. Bishop Barber, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about what you think happened in this election. Respond to Trump's presidency and where you think the Democrats went wrong.
Well, thank you, Amy, for getting up this morning and continuing to say Democracy Now. You know, we've got a lot of questions that we must wrestle with deeply. We can't be flippant or knee-jerk in this moment. We have to deal with the fact that America has often chosen wrong and had to pay for it later. We have to look at the fact that this week, 71 million, 72 million people chose to return Donald Trump to the White House despite his vitriol, his anger, his regressiveness, his outright racism and lean toward fascism. And we may not know exactly what he's going to do, and it may take him doing it to the point that even his followers are hurting so bad that they admit, they ask the question, what did we do? But Nikona Hannah-Jones said something the other day, and I shared it with my co-chair, Liz Steele Harris, and she reminded us that 60 years after America's first attempt at Reconstruction in the 1920s, right after the election of 1866 in that area, the majority of Americans went back and embraced white supremacy. And if we think about where we are, we're 60 years now after the 60s, after the white Southern strategy. And what did we see the other day? We've got to ask a deep question. We saw most Americans, many Americans, did not vote. Trump got 2 million, almost 3 million votes less than he did in 2020. Harris received almost 13, 14 million votes less than her and Biden received in 2020. They got 81 million votes. A lot of people just didn't vote. And what's the reason? We know that in 2020, when Harris and Biden and Harris focused on living wages and voting rights out front, that they got 56% of the votes of those that make less than $50,000 a year in a family of four. But this year, the exit polls showed that it was even 49-49. Trump came up, Democrats went down. And the question becomes, why? Did we adequately focus on the 30 million poor, low-wage, infrequent voters that held the key to the largest swing vote in the country? We reached out to more than 12 million of those persons. We've got some serious questions to wrestle with. Did white women, for instance, who are against taking abortion rights, then but also voted for Trump and chose Trump, they with Harris on the abortion issue, but not for presidency? Where did Hispanic men turn out? We have a lot of wrestling to do. Why is it that the issues that the most of the public agrees with, health care, living wages, voting rights, democracy, why is it that those issues weren't more upfront? And why is it that persons will choose to vote against for someone who's diametrically against the very things that the percentage of the people say that they're for? We have some serious issues. What we don't now have the option to do is to give up. You know, I do think there was some failure also in the media. You know, I didn't see one debate where there was a focus on poverty and low wage. Even though 800 people are dying a day from poverty, even though you have millions, over 32 million people making less than a living wage, we haven't raised the minimum wage since 2009, not one major debate You didn't hear about it in the Congress. Why didn't the Democrats, for instance, bring up living wage in the Senate before the election and force a vote on it to expose where the Republican Party actually stood on this critical issue? Because everywhere that raising the minimum wage and paid family leaves and things that matter was on the ballot, they won. They won in Nebraska, Missouri, and Alaska, and places like that. We have some serious questions to ask. But we also, lastly, Amy, I have to also say something. Somebody said Trump has a mandate. Nobody has a mandate to overturn the Constitution. Nobody has a mandate to engage something like Project 2025 to try to take us backwards and undo progress. Nobody has a mandate to say we're not going to address people who are literally dying from the ravages of poverty. Nobody has a mandate to say we're going to take away people's health care. We have to get up every morning from now until and steal with every nonviolent tool in our disposal and challenge any form of regression, regardless of who is in office. And I thought about this when Plessy versus Ferguson came down in 1896. The activists that chose against separate but equal fought 58 years until they overturned it. They got up and they continued the battle. And so we get up this morning, we got to go back to the same kind of strength that people had when they woke up in 1877 and there was an election to turn back America, or when 1896 happened, Plessy versus Ferguson, or 1914 when a white supremacist entered the White House, played Birth of a Nation in his Oval Office, in 1955 when they woke up and Emmett Till was killed, in 1963 when four girls were killed in a Birmingham church, 1963 when a president was assassinated, 1968 when Martin King was assassinated. People had to own their tears, own their pain, own their frustration, but then still get back up and declare that we will still fight for this democracy and will not just go away and slink away into the dark.
So I wanted to go to Independent Senator Bernie Sanders tweeting, "It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party which has abandoned working class people would find that the working class has abandoned them. While the Democratic leadership defends the status quo, the American people are angry and want change, and they're right." Well, the DNC chair, Jamie Harrison, called Sanders' statement straight up BS. He said, "Biden was the most pro-worker president of my lifetime." And then there was also the comment of David Brooke, who is the well-known columnist in the paper. And I wanted to go to that column. He wrote in a piece headlined, "Voters to Elites." This is the New York Times opinion columnist David Brooks. "Do you see me now?" He said, "I'm a moderate. I like it when Democratic candidates run to the center, but I have to confess Harris did that pretty effectively and it didn't work. Maybe the Democrats have to embrace a Bernie Sanders style disruption, something that will make people like me," David Brooks wrote, "feel uncomfortable." So if you can respond to that and give us the facts on the number of people we're talking about in this country. And of course, it's not just about numbers. It's about what people are dealing with, millions of people all over this country, and they could vote.
Right. And Amy, what we've got to do is get out of our feelings. It's a total different thing to say our policies were such and such and such and we help people. And whether or not that was articulated, and whether or not people got it. For instance, we know that, yes, we need tax credits, child tax credit, and we support that. And yes, we need health care. Money for housing, new housing. We're clear about that. We support that. But to say, wait a minute, we have to take a look. Where we were and what's going on, is it the messaging? What is it? Because what we know is in every around this country, raising, for instance, the minimum wage, that would affect 32 million people who live every day for less than living wage. For instance, yes, we need to deal with price gouging, but people also need money to buy goods, buy gas, buy whatever. And and we've not raised the minimum wage. Democrats or Republicans, we've sat on this issue now for 15 years. We're talking about 140 million poor, low-wage people. We're talking about 43% of our country that's poor and or low wealth. We're talking about adult population, people who make less, who are $500 away from economic ruin. We're talking about 800 people that die per day. This is not hyperbole. And we have to be able to talk about this. And to talk about it is not to say that a candidate was wrong. It is to evaluate what is going on and what is going to be our position. And why, for instance, that we did not make a determined effort right up front that every time we open our mouths, we said, listen, if you elect Democrats from the presidency to the Congress, in the first 50 days, first 100 days, we're going to raise the minimum wage to at least $15 or a little bit more. We have the data. Three Nobel Peace Prize economists won the Nobel Peace, proving that raising the minimum wage would not hurt jobs, would not force more taxes, and would not make prices rise. At some point, we have to take this very seriously. And you know, I know people, everybody's in their emotions, and should be. Now, that's not the only issue, though, and I would agree with Jamie in this. That's not the only issue. There's a lot of issues. That's why we have to drill down in this. What factor did race play? What factor did sexuality play and gender play? But we have to take serious that the fundamental issues, even in Mississippi, 66% of Republicans now say that they want health care, that they support the Affordable Care, or what we used to call Obamacare. We have to take seriously when we look at these other states. When living wages was on the ballot, it won. You know, do we need to then make sure that across the country we have these things on the ballot? But what we can't do is walk away from them. So we have to do introspection. We have to look at why there was less voting. We have to look at why when, and I remember in 2020 when Biden and Harris, when they were running, every time they talked, they said, if you elect us, we're going to do living wages and health care and voting rights. 56% of those who make less than $50,000 a year supported that ticket. We have to own the fact that some of this is not the Biden or Harris or anybody's fault. It started when the Democrats brought up for a vote to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and 8 Democrats joined every Republican and blocked it in the United States Senate after it passed the House. That we can't have Democrats running rogue when they have power and voting against something at that time would have impacted 55 million people, and it would still be at 55 million if Biden had not and Harris had not increased the minimum wage for federal workers. But you run rogue when you have power, and then when you come back to the people for election, you say, we're with you. People are hurting out here. People are dying out here. And until we can face poverty and low wages in this country, we're talking about 66 million white people. We're talking about 26 million black people, 60% of black people, 30% of white people, 68% of Latinos, 68% of indigenous people. We cannot walk away from this issue. And lastly, we cannot allow people to suggest that if you focus on this issue, that it's a far left issue. It's an American issue. It's a moral issue. It is the level of poverty and low wages in this country is a violation of our claim of our Constitution to establish justice and promote the general welfare. It is disgusting and damnable that we've not had a full-on dealing with this issue in the media, in the halls of Congress, and in our election. Not one presidential candidate was asked at any of the two debates that were held, where do you stand on the issue of poverty and low wages, and what are your plans to address it, and how will you lead this country that for issues that affect nearly 50% of the population? We got to face this issue. And that's why one of the things I'm saying, Amy, you know, Venus Williams said something in a poem that we all of us ought to read. It said, she said this, You are awakening to the same country you fell asleep to, the very same country. Pull yourself together, and when you see me, do not ask me, what do we do now or how do we get through the next 4 years? Some of my ancestors dealt with at least 400 years under worse conditions. She said, continue to do the good work. Continue to build bridges and not walls. Continue to lead with compassion. Continue to demand the liberation of all. I would add to that, continue and seriously fight for living wages and health care and the end to genocide around the world and the end to the battle of a war in Gaza. Continue the fight for women's rights. Continue to fight for children. Continue to fight to expand voting rights. How much of this low vote was because of voter suppression? Why is it in a state like North Carolina, for instance, all of the Democrats at the top of the ticket won? And yet the presidency did not win. We have to deal with some serious questions. We can't get in our emotions. We've got to ask serious questions because we have serious pain out here that people are hurting, and millions of them didn't vote either way. They just didn't vote. I want people to hear that. The vote totals went down. They didn't go up. They went down, and we have to take this very seriously.
Bishop William Barber, I want to thank you for being with us. National co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, co-author of the new book, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. Next up, we go to former Bernie Sanders advisor David Sirota. He's head of The Lever, and he wrote the article, Election 2024, How Billionaire Avengers Destroyed Democracy, back in 30 seconds.
And I guess you may not see it too. I know that you are tired. It's never ending.
Jasmine Jang singing Meet Me in Space at a New York Immigration Coalition rally Thursday night. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at where the Democrats went wrong, we're joined now by David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, host of its new investigative podcast, Master Plan. His new piece, headlined Election 2024, How Billionaire Avengers Destroyed Democracy. Those billionaires, David Sirota writes, included Elon Musk, who spent about $120 million to help Trump get elected and saw his net worth soar by over $16 billion after Trump secured victory. Other billionaires campaigned for Kamala Harris, such as Mark Cuban, who was her top TV surrogate, and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, who spoke at the Democratic National Convention in August. This is a clip.
Donald Trump thinks that we should trust him on the economy because he claims to be very rich. But take it from an actual billionaire. Trump is rich in only one thing, stupidity.
For more on how the Democrats lost the election and what is next, David Sirota joins us from snowy Denver, Colorado. His August piece for The Guardian is headlined Project 2025, started a half century ago. A Trump win could solidify it forever. And David Sirota was also senior communications advisor and speechwriter for Bernie Sanders when he ran for president. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, David. Talk about the billionaires.
Well, look, I think what was different about this election, and to be clear, there's been billionaires funding elections from the shadows, certainly an upsurge of that since the Citizens United decision. But I think what was different about this election was how central billionaires were in the entire political discourse. I mean, billionaires were on the national stage. Elon Musk, Mark Cuban, you had billionaires like Reid Hoffman, Barry Diller, demanding, if Kamala Harris won, demanding the firing of FTC chair Lina Khan. So billionaires were really in our face this time in a way that they really haven't been before. And billionaires, I should mention, were celebrated. That clip that you just played of billionaire Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Democratic Convention celebrating billionaires as a credential. And that speech came, by the way, right after Bernie Sanders spoke at the Democratic Convention saying we got to essentially reduce the power of billionaires in politics. So we've come a long way. And in my view, not in a great direction towards our elections being celebrations of billionaires, our elections being battlegrounds for billionaires to have their fights, to center their issues. And essentially what ends up happening is that the 2024 election that was supposed to be about saving democracy was essentially an exercise in destroying what was left of democracy, turning our elections themselves into an open celebration of the oligarchy. And I think if we simply walk away from this election and say, hey, the Democrats lost because they didn't have enough billionaires and the Republicans won because they more billionaire money went to Donald Trump, and we define our democracy as just a battle of billionaires, then the question is, in the battle to save democracy, what are we actually saving and for whom?
So during the presidential campaign, as you just said, two major Democratic donors, media mogul Barry Diller, LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, publicly called for Kamala Harris to fire the head of the Federal Trade Commission, Lina Khan, who's led Biden's antitrust efforts. Hoffman sits on the board of Microsoft, which was sued by the FTC. He was interviewed on CNN by Jake Tapper.
Thanks for joining us. So you and other big money donors are giving money to Vice President Harris, suggesting also that she replace the head of the FTC, which impacts policy and the economy. What do you say to somebody who watches this and says, this isn't how American politics should work, rich people getting to buy levels of influence?
Well, I totally agree with not buying levels of influence. I separate my role as a donor and expert. So if you ask me as a donor, I say I'm giving money to Kamala Harris because I think she's the best future president for the U.S., for business, for a bunch of other things. If you ask me as an expert about what, you know, kind of Lina Khan is doing and whether I think she is helping or hurting America relative to your anti-merger policies, which are, you know, mostly to bring litigation versus, you know, really solidly grounded in kind of what's going on and what helps American business thrive here and overseas, then I give an expert opinion. But I think donor and expert should be kept separate. And I've never tied the two ever in any conversation anywhere I've ever had.
So that's billionaire Reid Hoffman, supporter of Kamala Harris. David Sirota, since economy was a top issue, inflation a top issue, if you can talk about what it meant to be against Lina Khan and what she represented, but most importantly, the power of these billionaires, and not just, of course, on the Democratic side, because the Republican who won, President Trump, he had Elon Musk giving out $1 million a day to voters.
Look, I think the Lina Khan example is really important, because while Reid Hoffman insists that his money has nothing to do with his policy demands, functionally, that's not the way things work. I mean, Joe Biden back in the 1970s talked about this when he first got elected, about how money always comes with a demand. Money always comes in politics with strings attached. Functionally, the way this works, these people are not giving money simply out of the goodness of their own of their hearts. They want things. They have policy demands. And I think, as you mentioned, Elon Musk, that's another great example. I mean, Elon Musk running around spending big money to help elect Donald Trump while saying he's going to accept a job in the Trump administration, Donald Trump saying he's going to appoint him to a job that would oversee the reshaping of federal spending and the federal budget at a time when Elon Musk runs companies that are major federal contractors. So in a sense, Elon Musk could be in a job where he could shape the government to enrich the companies that Elon Musk owns. This is what money in politics really is. It is an investment. And the investors, the donors, like billionaires, are looking for a return on their investment. That's what this is, a business strategy.
So let's talk about what Musk is going to get in return. You report that the Senate Republicans' scheme to let Trump self-police ethics, Republicans have been blocking the appointment of the government's ethics enforcement official till after the election so that Trump can now appoint, as you put it, his own crony who can waive all ethics laws for his new White House and then address the issue of Project 2025.
So the Office of Government Ethics is the independent office that is supposed to enforce anti-corruption rules when it comes to the executive branch. When executive branch officials come into office, the Office of Government Ethics reviews whether they have conflicts of interest in their own holdings. And then we'll say you have to divest from this or that if your job is overseeing things that pose a conflict of interest for you. The Republicans, that job has been held open, blocked in the Senate by the Republicans for more than a year, kept that job open. And Senator Mike Lee of Utah has said he wants to keep it open. He said this in a floor speech in the Senate, saying they want to keep it open until after the election so that if Donald Trump wins, Donald Trump can appoint his own head of the Office of Government Ethics to a five-year term, which in practice would allow Trump to hire somebody who he would already know was going to enforce or not enforce this or that ethics laws for incoming executive branch officials. So would somebody like Elon Musk get a waiver from anti-corruption laws? Would any other billionaire serving in Donald Trump's cabinet get those kinds of waivers to allow them to essentially serve in dual roles, owning companies, but also running federal agencies that regulate those companies? And as it relates to Project 2025, one of the central tenets of Project 2025 is the initiative to help Trump appoint more political loyalists, in other words, decimating the civil service, the supposedly and supposed to be nonpartisan civil service. Again, when you think about packing the executive branch with Trump loyalists who may have financial conflicts of interest, and then consider that Trump will be able to effectively appoint his own political loyalist to oversee the enforcement or non-enforcement of anti-corruption and ethics laws, it puts together a situation where people may be coming into the government who are able to use the government to enrich themselves.
Can you talk about what Musk and Trump have been promoting, leading a new Department of Government Efficiency, the initials DOGE or DOGE, also referring to that meme coin cryptocurrency that Musk has been promoting?
Yeah, I mean, the best we can tell from what has been described is that Elon Musk is going to head up some kind of commission, potentially with a lot of cross-agency power, to propose and enact radical reshaping of the federal government, and potentially a radical privatization of government services, government activities. And again, I go back to the fact that Elon Musk runs companies that benefit from government privatization, contractors, SpaceX as the big example. So Elon Musk, the world's richest man, could be in a position to make recommendations about what government services to privatize, a privatization agenda that could ultimately send more contracts to the companies that Elon Musk owns.
David Sirota, thank you so much for being with us, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, host of the new investigative podcast, Master Plan. We'll link to your new piece, Election 2024, How Billionaire Avengers Destroy Democracy. Next up, we go to Amman, Jordan, to speak with Jan Egelin, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's just left Gaza. UNICEF and other groups describe conditions there as apocalyptic. Stay with us. I get it. Speak of the World by Tamer Nafar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As northern Gaza remains under a brutal Israeli siege for over a month, Al Jazeera reports at least 17 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli strikes on the north since dawn. This follows Israeli attacks on at least two schools turned shelters for displaced people in Gaza City Thursday. Survivors said the bombing came without warning.
We were baking bread and our children were sitting around us and we were at the bottom and we saw nobody and the floor shook. The bomb hit and all the tents were destroyed. People ran. Some people were martyred on the floor. Rubble fell on us and people were torn to pieces. Where is the humanity? Where is the rest of the world? Where is the mercy? We have never seen any nation waging war on children. I am 65 years old and I've never seen any nation waging war on children.
Over 1,800 Palestinians have been killed since Israel launched its deadly onslaught on the northern Gaza in October, many of them children, though that figure is likely a vast undercount, saying something like 70% of the population that has died are women and children. Meanwhile, Israeli attacks have also continued near central Gaza's Nusayr refugee camp and in Gaza City, where Israel's issued a new forced displacement order for Palestinians who have nowhere safe left to go. Top UN officials have again warned the entire Palestinian population in North Gaza, quote, is at imminent risk of dying from disease, famine, and violence, unquote. While UNICEF and other groups describe the conditions in northern Gaza as apocalyptic. For at least the past 7 weeks, Israel's persistently blocked life-saving humanitarian aid and food convoys from entering North Gaza, leaving families and children to starve. The last few operational hospitals in northern Gaza are on the brink of collapse, lacking critical supplies, while also coming under repeated Israeli attacks and raids, with many doctors and medical workers killed or detained. We go now to Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's joining us from Amman, Jordan. He just left Gaza. Can you tell us what you saw with your own eyes, Jan?
Yeah, I spent 3 days in Gaza, and I'm shattered, really, as a human being by seeing so much suffering from Rafah in the south to Gaza City in the north. It's devastation beyond belief. This is a small territory where there are 2.2 million people crammed together with no escape, and under the most intense and most indiscriminate bombardment anywhere in the world in recent memory. And while they also starved, because very little aid is coming in, and the little aid which is coming in has enormous problems in being distributed. And in northern Gaza, just next door to Gaza City where I was, there is a besiegement which is a deliberate starvation of the population there while they're being bombarded to depopulate the area. This is unlawful also beyond belief. Every rule in the Geneva Conventions are being trampled on in Gaza.
Can you comment on what's called the General's Plan, drafted by Israeli military officers, calling for the systematic denial of humanitarian aid in the north, which has basically been labeled as ethnic cleansing?
Yeah, I mean, this, a lot of people fear this plan, have heard about this plan, and I don't know whether it is official Israeli policy, but what I know is that the effect of the Israeli military campaign is that people are driven out of northern Gaza systematically. And the settlers, these are the criminal gangs in the West Bank that are colonizing the land of the Palestinians, they are celebrating the Trump victory because they want to go back also and colonize Gaza, especially the north, where people are driven out. The Israeli defense forces have said that it is a deliberate campaign to drive people out with no return. And that is called, under the Geneva Convention, forcible transfer of people, and it's an atrocity crime, and there will be justice for this.
What about the significance of Israel formally notifying the United Nations it's canceling the agreement with UNRWA? What does that mean for aid organizations like your own, the Norwegian Refugee Council, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees?
Yeah, what's important to convey here is that when Israel, which itself is a product of a General Assembly resolution in 1948, Israel was created by the United Nations in the General Assembly resolution. Many Palestinians were driven out then of their ancestral land. The UN saw that, and therefore a second resolution came for the Palestinian, and that was UNRWA, 1950. It was created to provide relief and work and opportunities for the Palestinian refugees. So now the product of the first resolution is killing the product of the second resolution, and it would lead to even more suffering for the Palestinian population, both in the West Bank and in Gaza in particular. And my organization, which has courageous humanitarian work on the ground, we provide water, shelter, education, relief, food for as many as we can. We're not able to take over what UNRWA is doing. They are the backbone of the relief to the Palestinian people. On the contrary, we would also be set back because they provide many of the logistics services, is their schools, is their fuel services, etc., that we, the non-governmental organizations, rely on.
So, Jan Eglin, let me ask you. Haaretz recently reported a senior Air Force official told Haaretz that without the American supply of weapons to the Israel Defense Forces, especially the Air Force, Israel would have had a hard time sustaining its war for more than a few months. Now, a leaked letter to Israel from Blinken, the Secretary of State, and Defense Secretary Austin, demanding Israel immediately allow U.S. humanitarian aid shipments to Gaza or face an interruption of arms shipments. They gave Israel until November 13th. Unclear why they have that grace period, but that's coming up. What would it mean if the U.S. stopped arming Israel?
I think it would be real leverage on this extreme policy, which is not self-defense. I mean, of course, Israel has a right of self-defense. All nations have that. And what they suffered on the 7th of October were terror and massacres beyond belief. And Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the others that were behind that has to be brought to justice. But what America has given indiscriminate arms to, and 2,000-pound bombs is no precision arm to go after terrorists. It is to level entire civilian neighborhoods. What the U.S. has fueled is an indiscriminate military campaign that is destroying the Gaza, which is filled to the brim with women and children that have no escape. So that is that the U.S. has not even been able to get Israel to provide the relief that we need to get in is beyond belief. It's been a diplomatic impotence that is astounding.
So you have President Biden that has given billions of dollars in aid, military weapons to Israel. Then you have incoming President Trump, whose son-in-law Jared Kushner talked about Gaza as valuable waterfront real estate. You are not only the head of a large refugee agency, but you are a seasoned diplomat. You were involved with one of the initiators of the peace talks that led to Oslo 93. What needs to happen now? Biden's still in office until January 20th. And then Trump takes over, expected to be even fierce as an even closer ally to Netanyahu.
Yeah, but he also wants to be close to the Gulf countries. And his son-in-law tried to negotiate this Abrams Accord, which was one between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and other Gulf countries. Which let out the Palestinians. But now the Gulf countries cannot accept any deal with Israel without some justice for the Palestinians. At that time, they could neglect the Palestinians. Not anymore. The public opinion in the Arab world would not accept it. So if Trump says America first, the present policy is Israel first, America second, and humanity third. Perhaps there could be some leverage now on Israel as the strongest party here, a ceasefire, end to the slaughter of civilians, a release for the hostages in exchange for a release of the arbitrarily detained Palestinians, and that could be the beginning of some peace process that could give justice and security to both sides. We cannot have wars every second year. It's not in Israel's interest to destroy its neighborhood in Gaza and in Lebanon. It will create new generations of hatred, and that is bad also for Israel.
Jan Egeland, your final comment right now, just after the U.S. election has taken place, the role that the U.S. plays when it comes to what Israel is doing, and what at this point, as endless UN and humanitarian organizations saying all of northern Gaza is on the verge of death, what Israel is trying to accomplish here?
What Israel is, has a cruel military logic, which is similar to that of President Assad of Syria, when he starved out besieged areas that were filled with civilians, but also with extremist militants inside. It's the same logic now for northern Gaza, where there's total besiegements of 100,000 people. I met some women who had come out with children, and they said, we were starving, we were being bombed, we left, and when we left, we were chased by Israeli tanks. I mean, this is the reality of this area, and the U.S. that has helped us in so many countries, from Sudan to the Sahel, to Colombia, to Myanmar,
Jan, we have 3 seconds.
Not been able to help us in Gaza.
Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, just out of Gaza. That does it for our show. A happy birthday to Diana Parra. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
WRCT Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.